The Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order for Thursday, March 6, 2008. We have a morning hearing. Senator Marty, if you're ready, we'll start with Senate File 2265, if that's okay with you.
Sit down here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2265 is a homeowner insurance non-renewal practice prohibition. And Senator Scheid, I know she is in another committee right now, and she said she hoped that we could move very slowly. So,
what Senator Scheid doesn't know won't hurt her.
So I will follow the chair's wishes. The Senate File 2265 is, I have an amendment I'd like to delete Section 2 and change the effective date, obviously, to August 1st, 2008. And I'd like to move that to put the bill in the shape. I'd like to present it.
On Senator Marty's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Marty.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the bill is fairly easy to see. It would be that you cannot... An insurer cannot change a policy based on a claim that was submitted that the insurer denied. In other words, if I make a claim on my homeowner's policy that for hail damage on my roof, which happened once and it was denied, and the fact that there was that claim requested and never paid, they cannot change their underwriting as a result of that for non-renewal. And I don't have any witnesses here today, and Mr. Johnson from Insurance Federation is here to say I think that they are fine with this in this shape.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We represent companies that write a majority of the homeowners insurance sold in the state. I've had an opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to visit with Senator Marty on this and indicate that in this statute, which is Senator Marty described, deals with the non-renewal laws of Minnesota, which basically provide that it delineates the circumstances and regulates or limits the circumstances that homeowners insurers can use to non-renew a policy. So if you buy a policy, it goes to the end of the term, then these state laws kick in. Senator Marty's bill, Senate File 2265, expands those specific grounds that limit the ground, you know, the bases that homeowners insurers can non-renew. And as I've indicated, we don't have any objections with adding these grounds to current law. There are a number of statutes and state agency rules that delineate the grounds. So this adds to that current statute, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman, there was a couple of years ago, had a number of people who had kind of, this is from a couple of years ago, a number of people who contacted us with concerns where they had had their policies not renewed and they had never had a successful claim against the company. I'm believing they were in Senator Rest's district, but Mr. Johnson and I were trying to recall where they were from. Okay. But I do not have anybody here today, and I don't believe this bill has to go to any other committees.
Okay. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2265? Further discussion from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 2265 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate File 2917, we actually have a delete everything amendment and three other amendments. However, they can't be treated as traditional author's amendments because this bill has already been through Judiciary Committee. But I'll invite Ron Elwood up to the table from Legal Services and briefly explain why we have delete everything amendment and three other amendments after it's been through another committee. And at that time, Senator Scheid suggested we just move it here because the two sides, this relates to manufactured homes, mobile homes, the lending practices and default procedures, and both sides have been talking with each other very well. They've been actually accomplishing some agreements, and this is a result of their agreements, the A5 amendment with these other 6, 7, and 8 amendments, which we will I will move them and ask the committee to put them on. But before that, I think it would be appropriate for Mr. Elwood to give some of the background and how we came to this, and then I'll move them.
Great. Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is an outgrowth of the working groups, one of the working groups in the foreclosure crisis intervention process that we had been convening over the summer. You heard just last week a series of bills. In fact, I think we had the Mortgage Foreclosure Day here last week, and this is one of the bills from that process. So that's the big context, the big picture. In short, this bill does really two major things. The first thing it does is allow additional time for a borrower with a manufactured home loan to reinstate after a default. Currently, the amount of time someone has after the default is 30 days. And, of course, if you compare that to a home mortgage, where the process can extend as long as a year, you see there's a bit of an imbalance, and the idea would be to give manufactured homeowners a little more time to get some refinancing, get some help from the foreclosure counselors and all that, the loan counselors, and get back on their feet. The second thing the bill does is take many of the, or the most important, actually, provisions that we passed last year, that you passed last year, with respect to cracking down on predatory mortgage lending, and apply them to manufactured home loans. So that's the big picture. I can briefly walk you through the bill, if that would be what is in order at this time. I will just try to compare the delete all to the original bill and explain what we did and where we made the change. But actually, before I do that, though, I want to be sure not to forget to really praise the Manufactured Home Park Owners Group and commend them, give them a lot of credit, and thank them for working with the resident groups, coming together in a very good faith negotiation to get to a place where we improve protections for residents while ensuring that the credit is going to be available for manufactured park home loans and addressing the concerns that the owners have in running their business day to day. So I really want to thank them very much for the effort.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to interrupt for a minute to point out to members that this is in some ways more difficult to deal with than regular homeownership situations, because the park owners obviously have an ownership stake here, and the mobile home owners also have. It's their home, it's their investment, same as any other homeowner, but this is more complicated because you've got two ownership issues there, and we have to try and protect both of them.
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing that I think we have to keep in mind as we're going down the road, this is still a bit of a work in progress. I'd say we're about 90% to the finish line. So we're going to ask you today to, after we explain the bill and where we are, to move it on down the road and allow us to continue our discussions to the ultimate bill and deal on this. The major change that we've accomplished here is starting on line page 1, line 4, and extending all the way to page 3, line 3. And that's the whole idea of the reinstatement and the ability to extend the period. The original bill had a much longer reinstatement period. After discussions, it was clear that was maybe going a little too far. So we've essentially come down to, boil it down, is folks will have a 60-day period now to reinstate. It's a little more complicated than that. The language that's here Still needs a little more work, but in concept, we are agreed that 60 days is going to be the period within which a manufactured home park owner will be able to reinstate. Starting on page 3, line 3, and going to page 4, line 7, is where we just add some definitions into the manufactured home statutes that were essentially taken from what we did last year on the predatory lending bill in the home mortgage. So we're just importing these things over to the manufactured home statutes. Beginning on page 4, line 9, is where we talk about what predatory lending practices will now be prohibited with respect to manufactured home loans. And while in the mortgage arena there are 27 some odd, what we did was to look through those and take the ones that we thought were most applicable in the chattel circumstances and the ones where we, both the owners and the resident groups, believe should not happen in any loan. And I will give you an example of some of the provisions that we've got in the bill right now. We don't think it's ever appropriate to charge a fee for a service that's not provided. We don't think it's ever okay to make a loan where the borrower, you cannot verify that the borrower has a reasonable ability to pay. That was such a fundamental cause of our mortgage crisis. We don't want to create and foster that in this arena either. We want to make sure that if a borrower has a special loan from a city or some other government entity or nonprofit for a very low interest rate or potentially a forgivable loan, that doesn't get churned and refinanced into a 15-18% loan, which is really never in the benefit of the borrower. We want to make sure that these loans don't get constantly flipped. That's never in the interest of the borrower. So I think those sorts of things we've all agreed should never happen, and we're going to prohibit them for manufactured home loans as we have for mortgage loans. Starting on page 5 and to the end of the bill is importing a concept that is in the mortgage lending statutes, but it has been tweaked here to make it more applicable to the manufactured home loan context. This is the provision that describes how much of the points and fees can be financed into the loan. Under the mortgage lending law, it's a cap of 5%. And we have changed the formula here and made it varying percentages based on the amount of the loan, because of course your home mortgages are, you know, upwards of $200,000 and that kind of thing. The manufactured homes, of course, are not at that level of value, so we needed to have a higher percentage being able to be financed into smaller amounts of the loan. So that just made good sense, and so we've imported the concept but tweaked it to apply in the manufactured housing context. I hope that gives you the basics of the bill. Maybe this would be the time to put the amendments on.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we have, as I mentioned at the beginning, the A5 amendment is reflecting their discussions, negotiations since we saw the bill in Judiciary Committee. And that's what Mr. Elwood was basically explaining, and I would move that amendment and then these other three that go with it.
So you're moving the A5 amendment at this time?
That's correct. And while it puts
and
it
that's what you just explained, I believe. So Senator Marty moves adoption of the A5 amendment. It is that delete everything amendment that was just explained to us. Members have any questions or discussion? All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Then, Madam Chair, the A6, 7, and 8 were all agreed to as well. The A6 amendment is simply adding the clause about making about that the discount points are not counted if there's a benefit to the borrower.
What, I would move Senator Marty, A6. What kind of a benefit did
this
you say that was?
This is the discount points.
No, I wanted you to read the word, Senator Marty. Concomitant.
Concomitant. Oh, I'm sorry.
We're kind of having a vocabulary lesson here.
Oh.
We'll have another one when I get to my
the
bill.
Same time. Okay.
So this is one of my favorite words, though.
We had some last night that were even worse for pronouncing, though.
So I suppose we should do this in order. On the A6, do you want to explain?
Sure. This is just to simply say that the lending fee does not include discount points if there's a concomitant benefit to the borrower.
Is there any discussion, members?
Yes.
All those in favor of the A6, Senator Marty's moved the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A7 amendment, Senator Marty?
Yeah, this is one that would prohibit prepayment penalties, and Mr. Elwood wanted to explain it in more detail.
Senator Marty, I want to ask a question. I'm sorry I was out of the room. I was at another meeting here at 8:30. So I want to be sure that I understand it.
Thank you.
Folks from the Manufactured Housing Association will probably be testifying here. Are some of these things, do they represent discussions that you've had?
Madam Chair, all of these amendments are what they've concluded on. There are still two small areas that are not in these amendments that they are still working on, one of which is private right of action, trying to figure out the answer to that. And there's also a question of whether federal rule that applies to one part of this. They're still trying to that's more finding out what's going on there.
Okay, I'm sorry. You may have said that earlier, but I didn't hear it. So, Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the A7 amendment, in the original bill, we had banned prepayment penalties, as we did last year, for subprime lending in the mortgage context. On further reflection and discussion, recognizing the differences between the chattel loan and the real property loan, we felt that an outright ban, and of course the subprime context doesn't make as much sense here as it does there. So instead of an outright ban, because we do recognize that there may be benefits to having prepayment penalties, but of course prepayment penalties are only make sense if there is a concomitant benefit to the borrower. And so what we did here essentially was to say that prepayment penalties are allowed so long as they constitute consideration for an equal or greater benefit to the borrower, just to make it clear that that's what they're for, and that's in this case is where they can be utilized.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'd just like to say thank you so much for this bill, because in the area where I live, where property values are relatively low and people are, on the whole, poor, this is something that has a lot of application in my district. So I really appreciate this bill. But I guess I'm a little concerned about the removal of that portion, and maybe you need to do that to make this move forward. I'm not sure. But it seems to me that almost anything could be considered a benefit. And is there going to have to be some documentation of that? I mean, since you're in such an unequal bargaining position when you go into these things, how would you ever prove that maybe the benefit is that you got the loan? You know, it seems to me that you're really taking out opening a big loophole that might eliminate the intent of this provision.
Mr. Elwood, or Senator Marty? Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think that's certainly an arguable point, but I'm not sure that I think it's in the lending world, it's certainly there's usually a quid pro quo. You're usually getting some kind of a lower interest rate in exchange for paying prepayment penalties, or the term of the loan is extended, or there is something. I suppose it's arguable that just getting the loan itself is a benefit, but I'm not sure that I think in the common understanding of what prepayment penalties are utilized for, we're doing this to essentially leave it to the courts to determine, obviously, but you know, in any case where there'd be a dispute. But essentially the idea is we want to prevent what has become such an abuse in the prepayment penalty arena in the mortgage lending area, which is you basically just get prepayment penalties and you get zero in return. And so that was the idea behind this. Perhaps we can think a little further as we go along of tightening it up to zeroing in on what we're trying to get at. That's the idea that we're trying to get at.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would just say also that for a couple of reasons in my district, at least, and I think this is probably true elsewhere, the reasons to draw distinctions between manufactured homes and other homes, you know, that line is really becoming blurred. For one thing, the prices of non-manufactured homes have really skyrocketed in my area in recent years, and the cost of manufactured homes, partially because the cost of everything else has gone up, but also because the quality has become much more comparable to stick-built homes. And the amount of the investment typically is something like $60,000 to $80,000, and so it is the largest person purchase that people are ever going to make, if that's, you know, what they desire or can only afford to buy. So I think, you know, that's just kind of raises an interesting issue. And then we have a lot of homes being brought in pieces, and they're kind of a hybrid between the two, but we're treating them as, you know, as the under the same laws as stick-built homes. So I guess that's just raises to me a question of whether it makes sense to, as you're doing, you're trying to treat them more equally here, and I think that's the right direction to go.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson's point is well stated, and again, I think the issue here, again, requiring there to be an equal or greater benefit to the borrower, you're right, they could claim that, but I think in a court we'll hope that it would be ruled differently, and hope that this does change the practice so there isn't so much of the prepayment penalties in the first place.
So, Senator Marty, you're moving.
I'm moving A7.
A7 amendment. Did anybody have other questions, discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. And then we have.
This is one that was, A8. I think, in the original bill, just exempting bank loans. And it was somehow or another left out in the discussions, but it was supposed to be in there. So I would move the A8 amendment.
I thought I saw some language about that. I thought I saw it in the bill. That's a separate section. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. members understand now that I do. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A8 amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I will say before we have any other witnesses or any other comments from Mr. Elwood that, again, we feel there's been good progress on this. We still want to resolve the private right of action and clarify that issue with the federal government. I can't even remember what the rule
is. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Marty and Mr. Elwood. I'm not sure if you're getting ready to move your bill, but one observation that occurs to me is I don't recall you saying that there's any exception in cases where the home has been abandoned. And I know that I'm not sure if that's in there, but I know that we just dealt with that with Senator Higgins' bill with private homes, and it would seem to me that if there's clear evidence a home has been abandoned, you wouldn't want it to sit there losing value and you know, causing problems for other people too.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Elwood.
Or Mr. Elwood, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, in Senator Hagan's bill, of course, we were dealing with the home mortgage context where there's a very lengthy period of redemption and reinstatement. Here, we're moving from 30 to 60 days. I'm not sure. I mean, it could be done in a pretty short amount of time. But, you know, we can look at the abandonment issue if you think there's a thank you. Mr. Bruner points out that in the delete all, we have a provision regarding voluntary surrender if there's an abandonment. So,
members, that would be page 2, section 4.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner.
So there is, that's permissive, but it's, I think it gets to the problem of having it being vacant. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Elwood could point me to the language, because I did notice that, but I was just, it looked to me like there had to be a written, I know I read this just quickly, but it looked like there had to be a written or voluntary surrender in order for the voluntary repossession to apply. And usually when these things are abandoned, people, they're gone. They've just left. And so, you know, that would be difficult to comply with when the property's been abandoned.
Mr. Bruner, yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mark Bruner, the Manufactured Housing Association. Madam Chair, Senator. What the idea of the voluntary repossession clause is so that, as you say, if someone decides to abandon the home, they can essentially surrender the title to the lender. In the case where they don't do that and abandon their home, my understanding is that there are other sections of law that would allow the lender essentially to take back the home, as well as the manufactured home park owner would certainly want to initiate some type of a replevin action.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, then I guess my suggestion would be that there'd be a good idea to have a cross-reference to that section and say that this isn't intended to supersede that, just to make sure that remedy isn't lost.
Senator Olson. That's good, Mr. Bruner. I think I understand what you're suggesting. I think that's probably a good suggestion. Is that, but Senator Marty?
Ms. Kaplan from APAC may have another comment on that as well.
Did you testify earlier?
I did not.
Okay, wait. Well, then introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm with All Parks Alliance for Change. We are the organization dedicated to preserving the rights of manufactured homeowners in the state of Minnesota. And on the point that Senator Olson brought up, and I think that it was addressed slightly, there is a provision in the tenant-landlord section of manufactured housing law in 327C that does allow, if a home remains vacant for a certain period of time, for somebody to basically proceed with what's essentially an eviction and then go through a process of, they can claim that it's abandoned property and go through a sheriff's sale process. So hopefully that, in conjunction with this, should clear up the issue of abandoned homes.
Mr. Bruner, you have a response to that?
I agree with what Ms. Kaplan said, that I think that, you know, together that would address the issue, and we can look at perhaps referencing or tying them together somehow in this section.
Senator Marty, you're going right to the floor with this bill, I think.
I believe that's the next step.
I think you started in judiciary, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did we
adopt? Of course, what's left, the irony is that one of the things that's left is a judiciary issue. But
right. But they are working on it, and if I don't remember where the bill is in the House, but again, they may have to do it, because I don't, better not to do these things on the floor. So
right.
Two committees in the House.
There are two yet in the House to go through.
Okay.
So
the members will understand that there will be some of these changes coming, and I think that's fine. That we're doing the work we're supposed to be doing, and I appreciate Senator Olson's.
Do we adopt the A8 amendment?
No, we have not yet.
I will move that and then suggest, if Mr. Bruner wants to testify or others, that we open up for that.
Senator Marty, thank you.
I think
we adopted the A8.
We did, okay.
Well, we probably shouldn't do that again. Mr. Bruner.
Madam Chair, I'd like to I'll thank Senator Marty and Ron Elwood for working with the industry on the bill. I mean, essentially, the original language did try to impose, if you will, the real estate provisions in statute addressing real property mortgages on these particular manufactured home loans that don't have real estate tied to them. Now, for the most part, you know, 85% of the new manufactured homes sold in Minnesota each year are financed with conforming real estate mortgages, and the things moving through the legislature this session will apply to those homes. We're talking about here are homes that are on leased land, if you will, and that most likely would be a manufactured home community. And that would affect probably 50-some thousand homes, and we estimate there are probably another 50,000 homes on leased land in Minnesota, mostly on farmland, where it may be family members that purchase a home and essentially finance only the home. So what we're doing here certainly does affect or address an issue related to homeowners in Minnesota. And we think we've come a long way in working with the advocates on language that will work for the lenders. I mean, they certainly have different parameters they use for financing a home that doesn't have real estate attached in terms of requirements. So we're satisfied with where we're headed. We do have a couple other issues to resolve that have been mentioned, and look forward to continuing our negotiations along those lines.
I think, Mr. Bruno, would I be correct in saying I think you're concerned about the private right of action? And I wanted to say that we did do that in the other area, and where we're talking about traditional home loans. I think we did include that in legislation. So I'm kind of inclined to support some parallel or equitable treatment of folks because it is their home. Mm-hmm. And so if that's any sense of, the direction I'd be headed, I wanted to share that and have it conform there. I don't know if it's particularly problematic, but I know you'll work that. You'll be working together.
That, yes.
And I really appreciate, and I think the committee appreciates, that you've all taken the time to have the give and take. That's what this is about. So, Mr. Bruno, do you have any other testimony?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on the bill?
Kumbaya.
Senator Metzen will now entertain us. We're getting used to entertainment.
Okay,
yes, we are. Senator Marty then moves that Senate file 2917 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion, members? On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and your bill has been passed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And, Madam Chair, you will know that I did start very slowly so you would have time.
I noticed that. Senator Marty, and now, of course, I should have offered this before we voted. The only prerequisite here is that you stay for my bill.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, no, you're good. You're the best. Oh, I'm sure.
What's not to like?
What's not to like on what?
On everything.
Oh, you're in a good mood.
We'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm going to offer what's technically, I suppose, is an author's amendment, but it does substantially change the direction or the nature of the legislation, so I feel that I ought to explain it to you first. Let me tell you how we got to this point. Members, this concerns bad faith legislation. This committee has heard more than its share of that issue and it's been presented to us several times, and we've had considerable discussion and debate since last year. I don't intend to... I think probably Senator Dahl is the only one who hasn't benefited from all of that conversation, and I won't ask for a vote, but I suspect that the committee would tell him to consider himself lucky. So we got here. I've been thinking... Members of this committee and members of the full body have suggested to me, you know, Senator Shide, can't you just come up with, can't you compromise, can't industry, the insurance industry, find some compromise here? It seems that there's a real commitment on the part of our caucus, although there's never been a vote in the caucus or really even discussion, but there's a sense that... it strongly urged that we do something in this direction. And my idea was, even last spring, but kind of after we finished with the session and we had no final action on the bill at the end of the day in May, that, you know, I'd like to consider an administrative remedy where the Department of Commerce would be asked to handle consumer complaints where people had disputes with their insurance company, and that I've thought that was a good idea, and I still do, but perhaps in more flush times. And although I don't, it would have been a system in the bill, the original language, that would have paid for itself through the insurance companies, et cetera, and the department would have had two or three people assigned to that, and insurance customer complaints could funnel through that. And then another thing happened, and some of the insurance companies, I mean, certainly, understandably, did not want to be covered by a bad faith statute. And members, by the way, I just this morning, and I'm sure there may have been some states where there's been action, but only about half of the states actually have a statute regarding bad faith. And Wisconsin is often touted as the kind of bad faith law Minnesota should have. And in fact, I think that the other bill dealing with bad faith that we'll hear this afternoon copies the Wisconsin standard for bad faith. The Wisconsin law is not statutory. It is court-made law. So, you know, Minnesota Supreme Court has not followed that path. They have not created a right for a bad faith action, either, you know, court-made law, and we don't have a statute. So, but I just wanted you to understand that not every state that has a bad faith law has it in statute, but I'm proposing with the language in front of you a statute that I think will be very carefully, tightly drawn and do what the proponents of bad faith legislation have wanted us to do, and that is to give consumers some recourse and even have attorney's fees paid in cases where an insurance company has, in a flaunting way, not recognized a worthy claim. And so that's what this is about. I'm going to ask for some help. I think I was reading this in my sleep last night, but you know, I'm not going to go into testimony about why we need a bad faith statute. I think members understand that we're kind of politically not at really the point where we're probably going to have one. I'd like it to be carefully and tightly drawn so that there aren't abuses, so we know what's in and what's out. And I'd ask Mr.
Hello.
Excuse me, just a moment.
I'm Bill Moran.
Bill Moran?
Right.
Moran. Good to meet you.
M-O-R-A-N.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure who will go first. Mr. Johnson.
Senator, Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And again, our members write a majority of the property casualty coverage sold in Minnesota, and auto and homeowners, the liability, the kind of key focus areas, I believe, of this bad faith debate. And we come here this morning and have been a participant in this debate for a number of years, and it's really over the last 2 years, but to support the delete everything amendment, as Senator Scheidt has put it before you. And as the debate has gone on, and the discussion about does Minnesota need to adopt additional remedy for consumers, and looking at the various states, this is a proposal that is based on, as I think Senator Scheidt said, the Illinois law.
I didn't say that.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's the Illinois law, and if some of you have seen the notebook that's circulated that describes the statutes and the common law developments, what goes on around America, there's a wide continuum of what states do or don't do in this area. But I'm really here just to kick this off, A, to put our face and name in terms of an organization, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and our members, to support this amendment that would significantly change and add to Minnesota law a new civil remedy for consumers in the property casualty lines of insurance. It's, again, based on a state that's had a law in the books and experience under it, and opens up directly the ability for consumers to collect what's called extra contractual damages, damages beyond what's in the insurance policy that they bought. If an insurer has engaged in, frankly, the kind of conduct that the proponents for a number of years has described, is the those instances where there's been bad behavior, whether it's called reckless disregard or, in other words, in those limited number of cases, and the proponents have very publicly described that the overwhelming majority of property casualty claims are handled properly and in accordance with the contracts and the state law of Minnesota in terms of what consumers are entitled to. So in those instances, and what this bill represents, I'll just comment on one paragraph, and then there's some more details that, depending on Senator Scheidt and what the committee wants to ask, most of the areas of this bill you will recognize if you've seen other bad faith, or as proponents call them, good faith bills, but they're referred to as bad faith laws around the country. Bad faith laws in terms of the who's covered, the scope, what policies are covered, what conduct triggers this remedy, and then what the remedies are for consumers. And this language picks up on this vexatious. It's a term that I'm not that familiar with in Minnesota common law, but it is a term that's used in a state, a significant insurance state, Illinois. And as you can see on page one of it, the vexatious is the specific language that delineates that bad conduct, if you will, on the part of a property casualty insurer in the handling of a claim. And if they trigger that, then the remedies that are in this bill, the new remedies for consumers, are activated and would become operational. So other than focusing on that, maybe I should stop and, for time purposes, Mr. Chairman, have our other witness here, and as Senator Scheidt would like to just walk through more specifics of what's in the bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Johnson. Chairman, and I just want
Senator Scheidt.
Mr. Chairman, does anybody want to walk through? I think I can. I know I can do some parts, and maybe since you haven't, I don't think necessarily heard the other bill or the testimony last year about this. One of the concerns we had was that this apply only to first party, and I think that this clearly states that. If you look at on page one, lines 1.6 through 1.10, that clarifies who the insured is, and it is the first party. And it specifically says it's not for a third party beneficiary. So this is your insurance policy covering you, and that is you and yours, if you will. And that is very important to make that clear, because the other language has been vague about that, and we didn't want to go that step to the third party. So in this section. Then insurer.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, to that issue, what would be the example of a third party?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Bill Moran, a member of the law firm of Moran Brandt down the street in St. Paul, and I'm here as part of the Insurance Federation member group. With regard to that specific example, Senator, that you're asking about, in this context, what we're talking about is a situation, for example, where you have a homeowner's policy and you have a hail damage claim to your roof, and you feel that you have been vexatiously treated in connection with the resolution of that claim. That is a first-party benefit that you're entitled to under your insurance policy, and as a consequence, you would have at least the ability to seek the remedies that would be allowed for under this bill through amendment as it's set forth in the bill through the courts as a taxable cost. And so that's the kind of a situation that is a first-party benefit. Gus?
No.
Senator Pretner,
Mr. Chair, my question, though, is what would be the third party? Would it be the person who repaired the roof or whatever?
Well, Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The third-party situation would be a situation, and this is, again, explained, I think, in the insurance policy definition as well. A third-party situation arises when, let's take your homeowner's policy again, for example, and you threw a rock and you hit your neighbor in the head, and your neighbor sued you. And in that situation, your homeowner's policy has a liability component to it, and that provides you a defense. In other words, a lawyer would be hired by the insurance company to defend you in that lawsuit, and if there is an ultimate verdict against you, that same policy would provide you insurance benefits through indemnification.
Okay, but Mr.
Senator
Chair,
we're
still not getting to the issue.
Right.
What is the third party that is not covered under the provisions of the bill? That's what was referenced.
Mr. Moran.
Mr. Chair, I apologize, and I was getting to that. Because
okay.
The third party in that circumstance is the person that was injured. And so, in other words, that third party would not have an ability to pursue a vexatious claim against the insurance company because of the way they handled your defense or how they negotiated the claim. That's one of the examples of the third-party situation.
Thank you.
Then,
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, and I was just going to say, we already recognize under case law in Minnesota the right to pursue a third-party claim.
Right.
And so I'm assuming that there's nothing in this statute that would be intended to interfere with that right that case law recognizes.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's just that in previous versions of this kind of legislation, it's not tightened down to make sure that it is, in this particular case, that it's only first party. And that's why I drew attention to this as a distinction. Okay. But not in terms of what the any other legislation you may have seen intends to do. I think this is what they intend to do, but this, I think, does it more carefully. Mr. Chairman, I know we have not acted on the amendment, and I think that's fine at this point, but I would like to offer an oral amendment on line 1.22 of the delete everything. And Mr. Stain can perhaps tell me. At the end, it says on 1.22, or any written agreement authorized under Section 60A.06, which is kind of the general listings of types of insurance that there are. It's general statute, I believe, on insurance. Subdivision 1, comma, clause parens 4 and 6. Mr. Stang, would that be appropriate? What clause 4 describes as falling under this, under insurance law in Minnesota. Clause 4 is life insurance, annuities, accidental death, and disability. Clause 6 is fidelity and surety types of insurance. So that would exclude those. And I will tell you about, parens B, but shortly, but let's deal with that if you mind. Mr. Stang could respond. Is that a better way to do it, or do we have to say subdivision 1 again?
Mr. Stang.
Madam Chair, I think clauses 4 and 6 is fine.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that.
Members understand the amendment. On Senator Scheid's oral amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, and this section describes what kind of insurance we're talking about, and the language we just amended starts on 119, and it says, well, excuse me, actually, up on 116, it clarifies that this doesn't obligate an insurer on defense expenses and other type of defense obligation or indemnification for judgments or settlements. I think that's more descriptive than of what's not included. And then it does not include workers' comp or health insurance or, as we just I just noted, life insurance, et cetera, those other types of insurance. So these are the – I think that all parties agree – whether they like this version or not, that this is what's intended. And I think this is very carefully drafted to do that. And then we get to my second favorite word of the day, vexatious.
Madam Chair. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, just because Illinois likes that word doesn't mean we need to use it. I think it would be, regardless of the other merits or whatever of the bill, I think that word would be worth changing to. I'm not sure what the appropriate word would be, but I've never heard a Minnesotan use that word before today.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Marty's being vexatious.
Senator Metzen.
But I, Mr.
Are you,
Chairman, I just
are
wanted to.
Oh, are you trying a second big word at us? I mean, the first one we just looked up.
Concomitant.
Vexatious. Intending to annoy or harass. So I knew all you people knew that, but I quite frankly didn't.
Right.
But now what's the next one we have to take?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I have another big word in here, but I think Senator Marty might be right. Missouri, I was looking at this morning, happens to use the word vexatious as well. It's often used to describe a lawsuit, I think, maybe more than conduct of a defendant, but there may be a better word. But I like it for the time being, if I may. I don't know, unless Senator Marty has another word, but that...
Not right now.
Then I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Moran and Mr. Thrain, and if you can add to anything that I missed here in these upper sections, that's fine.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To kind of expand on the question of vexatious, that is a term of art that's been used in the Illinois statute, and the definition that is contained within the draft bill has been derived from the case law that construes the Illinois statute. The term vexatious does find itself from time to time in Minnesota jurisprudence. In the context of frivolous lawsuits, you will see that. In reference to the various statutes relating to the frivolous lawsuit issue. And so it's not a term that is foreign to Minnesota jurisprudence. It's just not a term that I think has been defined statutorily as it is in this particular bill. With regard to how the statute is intended to work, I think I can give you an example of a situation in which a policyholder who has been vexed as a consequence of the conduct of an insurance company and which has engaged in vexatious conduct has suffered a loss. Situation arises, for example, in the hail damage claim issue that I had talked about earlier. A lawsuit is brought. The insurance company acts in a vexatious way. The case goes to a lawsuit. The policyholder feels that the insurance company has engaged in this vexatious conduct, has the right to seek an opportunity to assert that claim with the court. The court allows that claim to be asserted in the lawsuit. The matter goes to a verdict, and the insurance company has, say, offered $10,000 to resolve the case. The demand was $100,000 to resolve the case. A jury awards $80,000. And under the remedy section of the bill, the net effect of that award, and this is again assuming the vexatious conduct has been established, the remedy section would allow for a recovery of $35,000 in taxable costs as a consequence of this vexatious conduct. And that's kind of the calculus, and I can go through how that works. If we look at the remedy section, that's line 2.5 on, I guess it would be the second page of the bill.
You're right.
And just what they would get.
Senator Prettner Soul.
Oh,
that's
sure.
What they're going to need to.
I'm sorry.
Senator Prettner Soul.
Yes. I'm sorry to be so dense here, Mr. Chair, but so the insurer brings suit against the insurance company and the award to the insurer. The insurer or the insured?
Well, Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about if we call the policyholder?
The policyholder brings suit against the insurance company,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
And
Senator Prettner Soul.
And the insurance and the jury awards $80,000, but you said that the court costs were $100,000. Is that what you were saying?
No.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry. I didn't mean to speed through this because I know it's you know, it's a process, and it's not often simple. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the judge who's going to do this calculus. This is a court function. It's not something a jury is going to be dealing with. So a judge is going to calculate it, just like a judge would calculate costs and attorney's fees and other issues that are vested with the trial
court. I understand. I just want to know what
would be the result here in that
right.
situation.
Okay.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The demand to settle the case by the policyholder was $100,000.
Okay.
The matter went to a trial. A jury awarded $80,000, which is $70,000 more than was offered by the insurance company, but still less than what the demand was. And that the amount less than the demand is not as important as what the insurance company offered and what the award was by the jury.
And you're saying then that they're only awarded $35,000?
That's yes. They get the $80,000 verdict from the jury. And in addition to that, they get $35,000 in costs under this bill if they're able to establish that there's vexatious conduct.
And you arrived at
Senator
the 30,
Prettner-Solin.
I'm sorry,
that's
Mr.
Okay.
Chair. You arrived at the $35,000 because that was half of the $70,000 or what?
Correct.
Okay.
And the way in which the remedy section works is, and if you look at, I'll just read it, and so then we can kind of go through it here. In the remedy section, subdivision 3, an insured may be awarded either or both of the following amounts by the court as taxable costs of an insurer's violation of subdivision 2. An amount exceeding not exceeding the lesser of one half of the proceeds awarded, which are in excess of the amount offered by the insurer. What that means, and in the example I gave, Senator, was that the amount offered by the insurer was $10,000. The award was $80,000. The difference between those two numbers is $70,000. And under this analysis, the award for taxable costs would be $35,000 because that's half of the difference between what was offered and what was ultimately awarded. Now, those numbers, as you could see, could be ratcheted up to get to this $50,000 ultimately, where there's a bigger gap between what the award is and what the offer was. But in no event, the cap on the award of taxable costs in these actions would be $50,000. Or in this event, the award could not exceed $50,000.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson and Senator Scogin. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, we're doing so much work on the A2. I'd like to adopt it since that's what we're working with.
Okay. Senator Scogin, then maybe we'll move on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Is the claim for taxable costs done in a separate court setting then, or is that claim made through the process of finding a settlement?
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The process that is described in the proposed bill allows for the consideration of taxable costs to occur after the end of the trial or the end of the proceeding. And it's not unlike any other situation in which you're involved in a lawsuit, and at the end of the lawsuit, if there is an ability to recover attorney's fees or costs, that is a process of submission of documentation to the court. There may even be a hearing before the court in order to establish entitlement to that information. And so it's for lack of a better term, it's an ancillary proceeding to the underlying lawsuit. In other words, it's connected to the other lawsuit, but it's not held in front of a jury at trial. It's a separate proceeding that's held in front of the judge.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, just on as a point of procedure, as Senator Scheid knows, this is an issue I've paid a lot of attention to, and we've had many conversations over. And I was busy reading the first and looking at the first proposal you had. And as you said, this is an entirely different proposal. So I guess my concern with what Senator Johnson said, just as a point of procedure, is if we were going to adopt this, as if we were voting in favor of this, because that's not okay.
No. Mr.
Chairman, I wanted
to. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's not just a simple author's amendment, if you will, in the tradition of what we do. And so I wanted you to understand that it was different altogether, if you will. But if you vote to adopt this amendment, then it replaces the original language, and then we will ultimately vote on the bill.
Work on that.
But this is just to adopt this. And I think Senator Johnson, Senator Olson, make a good point here.
Right.
So I'd move the A2.
Put your name.
Members understand that? I think Senator Johnson's right. Then we're working on this document. So, on Senator Scheid's motion that we adopt the A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. So, members, we're working off the A2.
She had an amendment.
And it was amended.
And it was amended. I'm sorry.
And that goes with it.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, so that's really important to understand that part. I mean, it's real carefully drafted, but that would be on top of their award by the court. And then on line 210, and I'll let you continue, but there's the word and. So the court could do either or both. So this is starting, I think, with 211.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition, under the scenario I had described earlier, in addition to the recovery of the taxable cost of $35,000, where the offer was 10, the award was 80, the policyholder would also be entitled to make a petition to the court for an award of attorney's fees, which is an entirely new issue in Minnesota jurisprudence with regard to these types of claims. And the fee award that the policyholder would be entitled to seek recovery of would be in the amount of $20,000. Under the calculus set forth in this particular bill, that is the maximum amount that could be sought for the vexatious conduct. And it's got to be kept in mind that that amount of recovery, or the fees that are recoverable under this bill, are only recoverable with respect to the vexatious conduct. And so when a lawyer, for example, is representing his client or her client in the context of a lawsuit and is required to ultimately is able to assert a claim for taxable costs under the statute, that lawyer must keep track of their time in terms of not only pursuing or prosecuting the claim for the insurance proceeds, but also have separate line item entries relative to the time spent in establishing the vexatious conduct. And this is not an untypical process. The bill itself also contemplates the manner in which this type of information would be presented to the court. There's an established rule in Minnesota on the order of a rule of civil procedures, the Minnesota Rules of General Practice 119, that allows, when in the appropriate circumstances, a claim for attorney's fees is made to go before the trial court and present the appropriate documentation, affidavits, billing records, et cetera, to the court to establish that claim.
So,
Senator Scheid.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I mean, I think that this is clearly, you know, a point of my concern in the past over this bill, that we would see more lawsuits and higher, earlier settlements that may not necessarily stand up in court or might not be the award of a court, and that we would, the system would I don't know if the word's bombarded, but the system would be deluged with numerous kinds of claims. This narrows it. It focuses it. I don't think you will see the kind of increases in premiums, because you know that was my concern, that all of us premium payers were going to end up having increased premiums because, as we saw in California, there were increased lawsuits and increased costs, so much so that the court finally undid its previous ruling where it allowed these kinds of suits. So that's a major concern, and I think that this narrows it. It narrows the claim by description. It narrows which kinds of insurance, who the party is, and then I do think the fact that first half gives an award to a potential award to the insured, the policyholder, is different than what we've seen before, but I think it's at least quantifiable. And I think that's really important if we're concerned about the premiums that the people we represent are paying.
Senator Prettner-Soul and then Senator Olson. Senator Prettner-Soul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, so I'm trying to understand current practice would leave things wide open.
Senator Scheid,
Mr. Chairman, there is no cause of action
right now
in Minnesota for bad faith, either through the court, through court-made law or statute. So this is creating that, we're doing it.
So you're saying
tightly.
That if there's bad faith on the part of the insurance company, there's no opportunity for somebody to sue them.
Mr. Moran would respond to you. Mean as of today?
Yes.
Mr. Moran, under current law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under current law, there are very narrow opportunities to recover in bad faith situation in Minnesota. And without going into all the expansive details that involves, the most basic and most prevalent opportunity to recover in bad faith is when your insurance company is defending you. You have a $100,000 insurance policy. You lose the lawsuit, and it's a $200,000 verdict, and you're personally exposed for $100,000 over and above your policy limit. That is traditionally what's considered to be a scenario where bad faith could come into play. Under those circumstances, the limit of recovery that you could have from your insurance company, if you claim that they did not properly defend you and they took their interests above yours in going forward with the lawsuit, is the $100,000. You wouldn't be entitled to get attorney's fees. You wouldn't be entitled to get anything else. The difference between what your policy is and what the award is the maximum recovery. In other words, the court would reform the policy limits to address the amount of the award.
So,
Senator Prettner-Soul.
So what this does then is it says that you can go to court, and if judgment's in your favor, then you get what's awarded as the amount that seems to make you whole again. Plus, you get half of your court costs, or half of the difference between what was offered and what the judgment was, or a maximum of $50,000. And there are no punitive fees and no punitive costs awarded.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
Okay.
And I think it's important for members to understand this, but I don't want to get lost in the weeds. The remedy section would be more judiciary, and I know we have a couple attorneys, but for the rest of us, we want to make sure we continue to focus on it. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And And I just would like to, first of all, and I'm sure we're going to hear from others too, but I'd first of all just like to respond to a couple of the comments that were made by saying that, you know, we went into a lot of discussion about this last year. And the situation that was just being described about when we do have bad faith claims, that's the typical third-party type of situation we've talked about before. In terms of a first-party remedy, we haven't had one. We're one of, I guess, only one or two states that doesn't have either a statutory or a court case law remedy, which is why we're having this discussion now. And in terms of premiums going up, I guess I'd have to say that, you know, we're almost every other state has some type of remedy, and I don't know that our state, our insurance premiums are lower because of that. So I think if we try to find a fair consumer remedy here, the argument that premiums are going to go up, we've never seen any statistics to show we pay less for insurance here simply because we're one of the couple of states that don't have a consumer remedy. And I'd also say that in terms of California throwing out their bad faith law, from my understanding is that was not a first-party bad faith law, and I don't think that has any application to what we're talking about here. But I have a question, because this is something that I really haven't had time to digest or think about, because I'm just seeing it here now for the first time. But it seems to me as though it's requiring you know, one of the things that the insurance company has said they have a lot of concern about is more lawsuits and tying up the courts and that type of thing. It seems like the remedy requires that you have to get a judgment, meaning you have to go to court to be able to enforce some type of claim. And we know that a very, very, very small percentage of cases actually go to court. So to impose that requirement on an injured person attempting to prove bad faith seems like that would force more court cases to go to court, if I'm reading this correctly.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm recalling the language we've seen before, and I believe that requires a court action. Are you telling? I mean, I have not seen anything that didn't.
Senator Olson.
It created a bad faith cause of action.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, it looks to me, though, like you can't even measure your damages here unless it's in relation to a judgment, which would require you to have to go to court. That was not in the other bills that we were considering. And so, you know, you're looking at requiring a significant a person would never be able to have a way to measure their damages unless they went to court, and that's not the case in the other bills or the other approach that we've looked at. So that's one observation I would have, that I would think that this would force or require require lawsuits.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Moran, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, in connection with the Illinois bill, it is tied toward recovery of costs relative to bringing the underlying insurance claim is what it relates to. Obviously, if there's a dispute and it's not resolved, you're going to have a lawsuit that ensues. And as a consequence, under any circumstances, a policyholder is going to have to prove up vexatiousness. It just doesn't happen in a vacuum. And when you're talking about vexatiousness in the handling of a claim, there's going to be evidence relative to the claim that's going to be presented. In this bill, what this focuses on is, I suspect it's going to be a rare, rare day where you're going to be able to say this claim was handled vexatiously where it doesn't go to litigation. And so under those circumstances, it makes sense to have this as a component of the underlying claim, because the handling of the underlying claim is going to be inextricably intertwined with the vexatious conduct for which you're seeking redress in the bad faith context. And for that reason, there's going to have to be evidence proving up that you had a valid claim, that the insurance company had, in handling of that claim, acted in a certain way and it shortchanged you or did not treat you fairly, And that usually is going to be in the context of having a disagreement in terms of saying, on the one hand, I'm getting so lowballed by my insurance company, this doesn't even approach my reasonable damages. And on the other hand, you saying, no, these are my actual damages. This is what my out-of-pocket is. This is what I've got to pay in order to fix this house or whatever under the terms of my homeowner's policy. And when that battle is joined in the context of a lawsuit, and you go through the process and understand how that claim handling occurs, that's why you have the opportunity then to seek relief from the court in the form of taxable costs. That takes the form of this enhanced taxable cost, if you want to call it that, the half of the difference between the award and the offer, and also attorney's fees, which, again, is an unprecedented step in the first-party context in Minnesota.
Senator Pretnersol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm seeing a circumstance here where somebody who has really been wrongly treated by the insurance company, though, has to go to the trouble of going to court and then doesn't recover all their attorney's costs and all their court costs and everything else. Is that the case?
Well,
Mr. Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Under Minnesota law, if you, for example, in the roof damage scenario that I described for you before, if you go to a lawsuit on that, and let's say right now you feel that you've been vexatiously treated, you're entitled to recovery of contract damages under Minnesota law. And what contract damages are under Minnesota law would be the value of the loss to your roof within the policy limits, okay?
Senator Pretnersol.
Well, he can finish, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And so under those circumstances, you're not entitled to get your attorney's fees.
Okay.
Senator Pretnersol.
Mr. Chair, my concern is for the consumer, though. I mean, most of them are not wanting to go to court. Most of them are just wanting to be compensated for the cost of the damage. And so if they have to go to court to recover their costs, I mean, to recover the cost of the repair of the damage, shouldn't they also then be entitled to the court costs that have accrued as a result of that?
No.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, we're not talking about a second court action here. This is part of...
I understand.
Well, any bill you have seen before you required going to court. It required a lawsuit. And it just wasn't automatic that because you said there was a bad faith claim that you got all your attorney's fees and your award you wanted. You were going to court in any case of any bad faith legislation you have seen.
Senator
and this, we in many states that have a first party bad faith right of action, they don't award attorney's fees. So this is the first time that this side of the table, if you will, in this debate is saying we're willing to add that, plus the penalty in the first instance of item one there in the parens. And then item two speaks to the attorney's fees. So this, and they are capped, but it has to do with that portion of their cost of attorney's fees that are incurred because of the vexatious behavior of the insurance company.
Senator Pretnersol.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Scheid, I'm trying to understand. I don't know who's being frivolous here, but I'm thinking, if it's a frivolous lawsuit against the insurance company, I understand that. But if it's a rightful lawsuit against the insurance company, it doesn't seem that the consumer should have to bear the costs to recover their funds when the insurance company should have covered them in the first place.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I take your attention to that language that was just described to you about you get your award. I mean, let's say it happened and the insurance company did not act appropriately. You get your award for what the court deems it should be, and you get up to half of that, up to a cap of $50,000 on top of that, plus you get reasonable attorney's fees. We can't do that today.
Okay.
It's in addition to that.
Senator Johnson and Senator Olson have been waiting patiently. Senator Johnson, to this point.
On point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the attorney. Obviously, in a suit, you always ask for damages. Do they automatically just get thrown out, or are they ever awarded in a case like this?
Mr. Moran.
And if you could put a little more context, Senator, on your question. In a suit, obviously, you go to a verdict or you go through negotiations and settle the case. Oftentimes, you go to a trial and a jury says zero. Sometimes you go to a trial and the jury says whatever they're going to say in terms of the actual amount of the damages. And so, it's going to depend on the facts of each case in terms of how a jury is ultimately going to make that determination.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you just always ask for it. Okay, here's the claim, and here's the additional costs. You always ask for them, correct?
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You always, in terms of going forward with a lawsuit, that generally is a situation where you say, I've been wronged in this context by my insurance company. I'm entitled to recover some damages, and that's in the form of whatever the cost of repair of my home would be, for example. And that's what you would pursue in the context of a lawsuit against your insurance company.
But Senator Johnson, are the damages and attorney's costs separated?
You know, it's a credit card number.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the what we call the American law, and this is throughout the United States, this is the law, is that attorney's fees are not generally awardable in any lawsuit unless there is specific allowance for those awards under terms of a contract or under the terms of a statute. And so, for example, if there was a Human Rights Act violation that you were pursuing against your employer, the great state of Minnesota, and you were saying, I am entitled to, I was discriminated against, in that context, there's a specific provision in that statute that says, I am entitled to get my attorney's fees if I'm able to prove discrimination. So there's a specific statutory provision. Just as there's a statutory provision that we're talking about here today.
New?
Senator Johnson.
Now that's what you're proposing today. In the old law, is there any provision?
Mr. Moran.
And that's what Senator Scheid's been saying, no.
There is not any existing law that allows for recovery of attorney's fees in the context of a first-party insurance coverage or an insurance claim. There is a situation, however, where a party can recover attorney's fees if, let's say, your insurance company comes in and says, there's no coverage at all here, and we're going to deny our responsibility. And that's, again, in the third-party context. That's not in the context we're talking about in this bill. And if you are able to prove that you are entitled to have your insurance company come in and defend you in a lawsuit where you were sued and they failed to do that, then you would have an argument in that court to recover your attorney's fees. But that's a very specific and narrow situation. Up to this point in time, there has never been, to my knowledge, an award of attorney's fees in the context of the first-party bad faith situation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just generally speaking and not to the language of this bill, but members of the committee, from time to time, we see bills here that ask for attorney's fees. And we, you know, pass some of those and some we haven't. But it's usually in connection with the specific claim. I think that homeowner warranty kinds of issues came before us in the last couple of years, and they were seeking attorney's fees. I don't think we included that, but you will see legislation from time to time suggesting that attorney's fees be paid as part of a certain kind of claim. So I just want you to understand it is in addition to the damages. So that's important, and we're saying we agree that should happen, but there's a cap.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scheid, you know, I'm trying to compare or think through quickly all the different scenarios that could possibly come up and how this bill would affect them. And that's really hard to do this quickly. So I guess one thing I would urge the members is that, you know, there are a couple of differences, and I know that there's another bill that's going to be presented. One of the issues is under what circumstances are what's necessary to hold the insurance companies responsible. You know, there are a couple of different approaches. This is a vexatious one, and there are some limitations on it, and there are some exemptions. I noticed, like on page line 3.14, And I'm not even quite sure what those sections say, so I'm not sure what those exceptions are. But we have that issue, and then we have the remedies issue. And they're both very different. So I hope we're not going to, in a vacuum, make a decision without looking at the different approaches. But my question is, I'm trying to think of these different scenarios. So in a situation, let's just say, for example, where a person has very high damages, and this is typically where these cases have come up before in the third-party context. So someone has $300,000 or $500,000 worth of damage, or maybe even $1 million, and they have a minimal policy of $30,000 or $50,000, and they make an offer to settle with the insurance company.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, are we talking about the third-party situation? No, we're talking about first party. So the party is making the offer to settle?
Well,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I guess we'll just say it this way. No, I'm talking about a first-party situation. But let's just say they do have a full policy. So they make an offer to settle for the $300,000 claim, and they go forward to trial. And let's just say the insurance company offers them nothing or offers them very little. And they have an agreement, a standard agreement with their attorney to be paid on a one-third, that the attorney will take a one-third contingency fee because they've had to hire an attorney since the insurance company didn't settle with them, let's just say. So in that case, they go to court and they have to pay an attorney $100,000 out of their $300,000 claim, when if this insurance company had not acted vexatiously or in bad faith or whatever we're using. So it's cost that person $100,000 because of the insurance company's conduct. They had to hire an attorney when they shouldn't have had to hire an attorney if the insurance company had acted in good faith. This basically says they'd only get $20,000 of that $100,000 loss, and they'd be out $80,000 out of their own pocket. Is that kind of how this would work?
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way in which this works is it doesn't do harm to a contingent fee agreement. What it does focus on is on the vexatious conduct. And so if you look at the way the statute is crafted, it's not designed to address the breach of contract claim that I think what you're talking about there. What it's designed to address is the vexatious conduct to allow for extra contractual recovery of attorney's fees with a cap of $20,000.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not worried about the attorneys in this situation. I'm worried about the person, the person that's purchased the insurance policy. And so I'm not worried about the attorney's rights being protected or whether you're interfering with the contracts with the attorneys. I'm worried about a person that's had to go hire an attorney because the insurance company didn't do what they were supposed to do. And so when the person's made a claim, and they've got clearly a, say, $300,000, $500,000, million-dollar claim, whatever it may be, and the insurance company acts in bad faith and refuses to pay them, and so now they have to lose a third of what they should have had to go because they have to go hire an attorney. This would seem to limit their damages for that cost to only $20,000, even if it costs them $100,000 or more to have to have hired an attorney. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, just a couple of comments. Senator Olson, is that hopefully before you get to the lawyer litigation end of it, we've got a fair claim settlement practices law, a mechanism, the Commerce Department, that does a lot of enforcement and action on consumer complaints, including the instances you're talking about, and are able to do a lot of recoveries, settlements of disputes, pre any lawyer involvement. So I know it's not the committee's before today. It was in the original version of the bill. The point is that there are additional steps in Minnesota a consumer and all of these types of insurance have available to them. And we have a good track record of the agency producing the benefits under the contract without lawyer involvement. I think, Mr. Chairman, for us as an industry, as we've been challenged by the proponents of this law to look at the 46 states and to say, what can Minnesota do? And as Senator Scheid has said, you know, we have a landscape today. Every consumer or policyholder in every state has the right to sue their company on the contract action. And in all the states, they pay their own attorney's fees. That's the American rule. And so what we're talking about today is that in those more limited instances where there is bad behavior on a property casualty claim, should there be additional rights beyond the contract rights that all consumers have in all 50 states today? And the states around America do different things, including in a number of them, I've underscored, Senator Olson, they don't pay attorney's fees in these bad faith causes of action. That's a zero column, so it's all on the consumer. There's no additional money. So from our perspective, we've been challenged to look at the states, look at what America is doing, and frankly offer a remedy that's in addition to the contract that pays damages beyond whatever the contract amount is, and frankly that pays attorney's fees beyond what we see in all 50 states in this country. You pay your own attorneys out of your own pocket unless there's some statute or a contract. So we don't think it's unreasonable. It's a substantial offering. It's a change of position from our industry's perspective publicly and coming to this legislature, different than what we've taken over the last 25 years. It's offering a for real new additional consumer civil remedy that pays damages beyond the contract and pays attorney's fees that don't come out of the consumer's pocket. We think it's significant, it's substantial, and it's going to help the landscape to deal with bad conduct in those limited instances where the proponents say there's bad conduct that needs a remedy attached to it. So we think it's responsive. It answers the question about what else can you do beyond administrative enforcement, and this does that.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to say that I think the short answer to my question is yes, the attorney would, or the consumer would lose their $80,000 under those circumstances that I just described. There is no remedy through the Department of Commerce that's enforceable to give that person to make that person whole. We don't have that kind of remedy, and that's why we're looking at this type of thing here today. And so I think the short answer is this would not make the consumer whole when the insurance company acted in bad faith. They could potentially be out $80,000 or hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on the value or in the overall value of their claim. So I appreciate that the insurance companies are recognizing that we need a remedy in this state. But, you know, there are a wide variety of remedies. In Florida, for example, that happens to be one that I think works well and one that I would favor. And basically what that says is, if the person who's insured offers to settle within the insurance contract, and let's say they have a $30,000 insurance policy because that's the minimum the law requires, and the insurance company in bad faith refuses to pay, they go to court and they have several hundred thousand dollars worth of damages. The insurance company then has to pay all of those damages because they had an opportunity to settle within the limits of their Senator Johnson likes that one. you know, that would be certainly something I think the insurance companies would like a whole lot less, even though it seems to me to be straightforward, makes sense, and would be fair to consumers. This, to me, seems to be not something that's going to, in many, many circumstances, allow consumers to be made whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'd argue that any language I've ever seen on this subject may not have left the consumer, the policyholder, whole. This is a dramatic change in position and an acceptance of the fact that this legislature seems to be moving in the direction of awarding attorneys' fees where we do not often do that. And this is significant, I'd say. And I think there's an awful lot in here that probably belongs in the Judiciary Committee. There's a lot of language that we haven't discussed yet. I don't know if Mr. Thrain wanted to say anything to add to this, but it's my understanding, for example, maybe the committee knows taxable costs
are those that you are, you know, you can legally charge for. They're accessible to the claim, and there is discretion in other language, discretion for the court in other bills I have seen regarding this subject, and there is discretion here as well. Then I don't know, did you have anything you wanted to say toward the end of the bill? I kind of want to get us through what's in here, and then members, you know, are free to vote for it or not. You will hear another proposal this afternoon at our 12:30 hearing. Hopefully, it, you know, I think it's, I'm not sure what we will see then, but I know that we're having another bill. Senator Clark's bill will be here. But this is one option that I would like very much for the committee to support and to say that we think this is moving in the right direction. And it is compromise that many members have said, can't you find a compromise? And it is. So, do you want to go up?
Sure.
Just through it here.
Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of conclude here, this is a sea change in Minnesota law. This is something that Minnesota law has not seen in the past. What the Minnesota legislature has done in the past is created certain other remedies in first-party situations to address specific small claim situations. An example would be the no-fault arbitration provision. Another example is by mandating in fire policy, fire insurance policies, appraisal provisions. And in the bill, those issues are contemplated and are carved out because those systems work. Those systems are a product of legislation designed to address small claims. For example, a no-fault arbitration scenario, if you have a small property damage claim to your vehicle, a collision claim, a comprehensive claim, or a medical benefit claim, that goes into the binding arbitration situation. And so those situations were specifically designed to address the first-party insurance factor and recurring claims in that arena.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, would anyone else like to testify in Senate File 3116? Senator Shy?
Mr. Chairman, then I'd move that Senate File 3116, as amended, be recommended to pass, and it would be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Further discussion on Senator Scheid's motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill is passed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I don't know if there are announcements. The good news is we're not meeting tonight.
We're going to recess. We're going to come back at 12:30. We have four more bills on our agenda. So.
And, Mr. Chairman, depending on how well we do this afternoon, that will tell us whether or not we need to meet tomorrow morning. We have the room reserved.
Okay.
And I know none of us want to do that, but if we don't finish, we'll have to.
All right.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
So, Peter, did he testify, sir? Do you have your card?
John. Please, someone ask you.
What's your strategy?